I must begin this series of seminars, of six long seminars, with a prologue, a very personal prologue. Over the last 2 decades, I've struggled many times with trying to find the right words to introduce a series of lectures about C.G. Jung, or a single lecture about Jung. Those first words have always been to me like the key to a door. Once I find that, I can open the door and walk on in and meet what's waiting. But finding those first words is always a gut-wrenching struggle for me, no matter how many notes and prior lectures I happen to have in my file. I have to say this time what's true to this moment. My understanding of Jung is not static. It's a dynamic relationship. It's been growing and it's been maturing for more than 25 years. I've been maturing for more than 25 years too. It does change your perspective. And so the words I speak right now have to both come from something authentic in me at this moment that wants to be said, and hopefully, at the same time, they have to intuit a need in you of what you need to know, of what you need to understand about this seminal figure of modern culture. So finding the right words always becomes a dual quest, a quest to be authentic to what's in me and intuit authentically what's waiting, what's receptive, what's needed in you. Over the course of more than 20 years, I've given several lectures on Jung, and they're little vignettes, little fragments, pieces of things that have always seemed to me like the door of that moment. Things that meant something to me. There's a stone on the parsonage in Kesfeld, on the shores of Lake Constance, where C.G. Jung was born. And when I first saw those words, they struck a truth in me. They resonated. On that stone, it says, "In this house was born Carl Gustav Jung. July 26, 1875 to June 6, 1961. Explorer of the human soul and its hidden depths." That struck me as true. Is it true? These little vignettes, these little stories, these little doorways, the question is, are they valid? Are they true? Is that a history, or is that an imaginative story about a man? I mean, the house is there. The stone is there. Good, solid Swiss stone. That's history. And the words are there. Is that history? Where is that intersection between a man's story and a man's history? There's another fragment that I heard years ago. A friend recently recalled to me the details, and when he told me again the story, I realized that I had recalled the story wrong. There's a story of a woman, and actually, when I recalled the story, I had personalized it. I'd made it into a male figure, but a woman who was on a ferry boat crossing Lake Zurich sometime in the 40s. I don't remember the exact date. The Lake of Zurich is a very, very, very long lake, and it's much faster to go across it than it is to try to go around it, and there are ferries that do that. And she was crossing the lake, sitting in the ferry. There at the prow of the ferry, she saw a remarkable individual, with the wind in his hair, staring at the water, smoking
a pipe.
She couldn't take her eyes off of this individual, this wizened figure. A Swiss farmer was sitting next to her on the bench on the ferry, saw her concentration on this solitary older man at the prow, and eventually he leaned over to her and elbowed her and said,
Das ist unser Hexenmeister.
There. That's our wizard. Is that a history? Is that a story? It is a history that, as best as human recollection goes, happened. The woman who it happened to related the event to my friend, who related it to me, and I may have recalled it wrong. It is a history that there were several Swissmen who did actually think of Jung as something of a wizard. And you have to remember Jung's home canton was in Basel, and most of his life he lived in Zurich. These are very strong Swiss Reform Protestant cantons, which do not necessarily take well to wizards, whatever a wizard is. Are there wizards? Did I just tell you a story, or am I telling you something true? Or is it all mixed up? What is this man, Carl Jung's history? What's his story? And where's the truth in it all? Sometimes when I've been in an academic frame of mind, approaching an academic group, I've found that key, that door, talking about Jung in the context of the birth of modern psychology, as one of the fathers of modern psychology, and develop the subject a bit from there, historically speaking, Freud and all that stuff. Well, my daughter greatly looked forward to her first class in college in psychology, which she thought she might major in. I mean, she had spent essentially the entirety of her life listening to her parents talk about Jung and psychology. So she was really quite interested in getting to a college course where, you know, she could learn more from another perspective. And I remember her finally, after about the third week of her class, coming up to me and showing me her textbook and asking me if I thought something was wrong here. Because in this $100 textbook that she had to purchase for her course, there was one paragraph on C.G. Jung. So, was Jung the father of modern psychology? One paragraph? I mean, in my book, this man was one of the most important psychologists of our age. One paragraph. So, father of modern psychology? Well, depends on how you tell that story, doesn't it? And then in an apocalyptic vein, sometimes the doors seem to be a famous quote filmed in an interview of Jung in 1959 for BBC television, where the man sits there in his chair and says, "The world hangs by a thread." And that is the psyche of man. But we know nothing about it. We know nothing about it. Is that true? Does the world hang by a thread? No, it circles the sun. Is that a story that's true? Is that part of our history? I mean, we're hanging here. I think we'd be a bit crazy if we didn't actually ask the question. But over many years, reaching back to my own first encounter with Jung, there's a keynote, a key, that I've always felt was the centering fact of Jung's story and his history, as I knew it, as I heard it. It was the keynote of the first lecture I gave about Jung at the University of Utah in a seminar hosted by old Ed Firmage, who some of you probably knew. But I haven't really felt ready in 20 years to return to it. It has remained the sustaining center of my understanding of Jung. But it is, however, intensely personal. It's connected with my own personal life, with my vocation, and with a lot of affect, a lot of very deep feelings. As I pondered this seminar over the summer, and indeed I spent some of that time pondering it in Zurich, visiting Jung's tower on the anniversary, the 50th anniversary of his death, and visiting his grave, I realized that this was the key that I had to open the door with tonight, the key I had to share with you. Explorer of the human soul and its hidden depths, pioneering psychologist, seminal modern therapist, prophet, mystic, Gnostic, madman, heretic, all of those categories, those defining terms have been affixed before the name of C.G. Jung. But there's one label that rightfully stood before the name of that man for 60 years of his life. It was Dr. Dr. Carl Gustav Jung. He was a physician, and a remarkable physician. He was dedicated, as best I can tell, and I have attempted to know this guy, he was dedicated, as best I can tell, more intensely, more genuinely, more completely, to the care of his patients, of his fellow humans, as any physician I have known, now know, or imagine that in my life I ever could know. So, tonight, in the prologue, in the beginning of these six seminar evenings, I would like to introduce Dr. Jung. The story and the history of a physician dedicated to the healing of a wound. I know that many of you are therapists. So you're engaged in the role of tending what we euphemistically call mental health. And I see some gray hair in the audience, even if it be at the troublesome roots only. And I suspect a lot of you have earned that. You've been engaged with what we call mental health, or what might be more appropriately called the terrible burden, the terrible rending burden of diseases of the soul, pathology, pain of the soul. Others of you, well, you've been engaged with your own psyche, with your own suffering, with your own cure. Those who came to vocations in psychological fields, in the caring, healing fields, often did so, have done so, because they sensed a wound in themselves, a wound that they wanted to understand, a wound to which they would dedicate themselves in trying to ameliorate. to help in this world. So at the beginning of this series, I have to say, and you have to understand, I'm not a therapist. I'm not an analyst. And I'm not a psychologist. I am simply a physician. I'm a doctor. A doctor of medicine. As a physician for over 3 decades, I have stood at the doorway of a windowless world my colleagues and I refer to as the pit, the ER, the emergency room. I'm an emergency room doctor. In my service in that pit over these years, I've seen about 100,000 patients. It's a startling number. It startles me. But you know, it's true. 300 a month, over 3,000 every year, over 30 years. I remember lots of stories, histories, and I remember lots of patients. I think I know something about the wounds of life. The wounds that we face. And so the time has come for me to speak from that solid ground of experience. It may be the only way I can help you understand Jung, C.G. Jung, Dr. Jung. I must tell you about him through my own eyes. They're the eyes with which I see him, with which I know him. So tonight, I have to tell you about Jung, the doctor, the physician who confronted a wound. You know, the physician has a story, an archetypal story. This concept that there's somebody in our world, some fellow, some human fellow, who can heal disease, who knows how to take care of our woundedness. It has a very long history. It has an archetypal image. It is a sacred and profane profession. And throughout the history of humankind, it has been seen in those ways. It is sometimes mixed up with forces not only physical, but apparently sometimes spiritual, shamanistic, magical, even with magic potions and incantations and actions. Over the years I've practiced as a doctor, I've worked mainly in academic teaching facilities, at least for part of my time. And part of my duties have always been to attend to the training of young physicians, not in classroom settings, but in their interactions with their patients, or having them interact with me, see what I do by my interaction with a patient, teach them about a wound, a pathology, a diagnosis, a road to treatment. Over those years, sometimes I've told a few of those doctors a story. You know, when you walk out of medical school with that label, MD, on your name for the first time, and walk into a room for the first time to take care of somebody, you're carrying a pretty heavy weight on your shoulders. It can be crushing. And sometimes over the years, as I've seen these young guys and girls struggling with this weight, I felt a need to talk to them a little bit. There's a story I've told them sometimes. As they're coming to terms with what they are as a doctor, of the duties they've taken upon themselves and of the task they face, there's a story of that that goes back to the very beginnings of Western society, of Western culture, There's a myth of the first patient and the first physician, the archetypal image of what it was to be a physician. You know, people who are interested in Jung often find that myths have meaning, that they orient us in some way to the tasks of our everyday lives. I'll tell you the story briefly, and the way I sometimes tell those young doctors. The first teacher of the first physician was named Chiron in Greek myth, in Greek legend. And of course, I should add, as most of you are well aware, all of these old myths are told many ways. They were told across hundreds of years of Greek culture, and they were told in different ways by different voices from different cultural perspectives. Every storyteller told the story through his own voice. Chiron was born of the intercourse of Chronos, time, the first archetypal form of time, the Titan, time, was born of the illicit intercourse of time with a dryad, a water spirit. Phalaria was her name. She was a daughter of Oceanus, the waters of creation. Well, like all of these Greek gods, Titans, Cronos had a syzygy. He had a partner, a wife. Her name was Rhea. In classical Greek mythology, she's sometimes referred to as the mother of the gods. While Cronos was getting it on, shall we say, with this spirit of earth, with Phalaria, Rhea shows up. Well, Cronos, to hide what he's doing, immediately transforms himself into the form of a stallion. Unfortunately, as a result, or fortunately, or just because that's what happened, the child was born, half in the form of a god-man, and half an animal, half a horse. Chiron was the first centaur. He lived in a cave on a mountain called Mount Pelion in Greece. And he became the teacher, the master of most of the great heroes of Greece. Jason, of Heracles, of Orpheus. The master of the heroes, of the father of poetry and of song. But he also became the first teacher, the first patient, the first master of the first physician. That physician's name was Asclepius. It is his staff, and wrapped with a serpent that physicians wear on their lapels sometimes, and certainly in their iconography and their symbol systems, that staff resides with the physician to this day. Asclepius himself, this image of the first physician, this first doctor, is also a paradoxical figure. His father was Apollo. His mother was a human woman. You know, I've always taken a lesson from this. You know, if you look at the Greek gods, they always seemed more interested in human women than goddesses. I mean, I've always understood that point of view. Well, Apollo saw the mother of the who would be the mother of Asclepius, the first doctor, bathing in a lake. Her name varies in the various myths. Sometimes it's Cronus. Sometimes she's related to Persephone, who spent half of her life in the sunny world during the spring and summer, and then in the fall with the equinox returned to the dark realm of Hades, Pluto. Her name in many instances is related to the moon, the waxing and waning, change of the nature of woman. A child was conceived of this union of Apollo and a woman of Earth. But the mother, after being impregnated by a god, married a man. This infuriated Apollo, and she was destroyed. And on her funeral pyre, in the flames of her cremation, the first physician was born. Apollo took Asclepius from that funeral pyre, took the babe to the teacher of all the great heroes of ancient Greece, Chiron, to be tutored and raised. There's something I didn't tell you about Chiron that I have to add. Chiron was a creature crossed, half a god-man, half a four-hoofed animal walking on this earth, divided. He was the noblest of all the centaurs, but belonged to a race noted for their lust, for their drinking, for the chaos they brought to this world. That's what centaurs were. If you look at the old Greek vases, these guys usually have a big jug of wine in one hand and rather large genitals someplace near the other half. Chiron was wounded in more than one way. Heracles, after his labors, had killed the Hydra, the multi-headed serpentine beast of this world, and taken the venom of the Hydra and poisoned arrows that he kept in his sheath. Heracles had come to visit his master, Chiron. And the story varies as to how it happens. Whether Chiron was simply holding the arrow, whether he's trying to put it in the bow, or whether by accident Heracles shot him with an arrow. But the arrow wounded Chiron, and Chiron suffered from a wound, a magic wound, a wound that would not heal, that festered, and that caused this immortal, ever-enduring mortal pain. Chiron was wounded. Asclepius wished to heal the wound of his master. And he could not. That's the story of the first physician. Who was his teacher? His teacher was a beast, an animal, who was also half an immortal god. His teacher was wounded and suffering. The tales say that someplace before the cave of Chiron, the cave, half up a mountain, half between heaven, half between earth, a cave which looked out onto the sunny vales before Mount Pelion, a cave which myth says was an entry to the underworld of Hades, of darkness and of death. This figure who stood at the center of a cross, wounded, was the patient and the teacher and the master of he who would be the healer, the physician. As I've told that story over the years, some of those people I've spoken to, some of those young doctors, I think, got the point. You know, we come to these healing arts because of what? There's a wound. A wound. What is that wound? I've looked at 100,000 people who thought they were wounded, suffering. Sometimes it was very minor. Sometimes they died. They died while I was trying to help and could not heal a wound. As far as painful wounds, believe me, I know from experience every most painful wound in this world. I could draw a list up and start at the top and work down from the worst suffering, the worst pains that people physically suffer. I've treated them all. But let me tell you, in the story of the physician, in the experience of the physician, in the experience of this doctor who has stood at the doorway of that pit, there's a wound which is more painful. More suffering comes from this wound than any somatic malady, be it a crush, a knife, a burn. That suffering is the suffering of the human psyche. The suffering of the human psyche. What doctor can face the woundedness of this world without recognizing that wound? It's part of his story. It's part of the story of that first patient. Mortal, immortal, wounded, and eternally suffering. And the wound he was suffering from was caused by the venom of a magical, mystical fact. The first patient born of a random interaction of time in the creative waters of this world. You don't have to see it 100,000 times to know it, because I know each of every one of you have seen it. Right? You've worked with it. You felt compassion. Compassio. Compassion, cum, with, patio, suffering. The same word, patior, in Latin, is the word for patient. You've been with the suffering one. You've had compassion. But do you have a name for the wound? Can you define it? Do you know how to heal it? You know, there's another old element of this prologue, the story of the physician. It's a very, very ancient tale of the healer, of the tradition of the physician. And that's that to understand the wound is essential to understand the healing. Part one. And part two is that in understanding the wound, one sometimes understands the healing. That the healing might be in the wound. That's a strange one. You know, the word pharmacy, medicine, pharmacist, comes from an old Greek word, pharmakon. And you know what that word means? Potion and poison. There's no potion I give that isn't a poison. And there is also a sense that the poison, the injuring thing, might also be the potion, sympathetic medicine. You know, in all the old mythologies, if you're wounded by a magic weapon, where's the cure? In the magic weapon. Remember the Grail legend, Parsifal, Amfortas. Amfortas has a wound. And what does it take, at least in Wagner's opera, in that last act? The wound has to be touched with the wounding fact. That lance, that wounded, that heals. Okay? There's something else you've got to catch here. And I emphasize this again and again when I'm talking to young doctors. The teacher of the physician is the patient. That's where you learn. No matter how many books you've read or how many pictures you've looked at, until you meet the patient, you know nothing. And if you look at that patient without recognizing a teacher, you're not going to ever understand the burden, the duty that you have. You know, I knew that. I learned that when I was an intern, long before I ever heard of Chiron or of Asclepius. There was a doctor I was taking care of. He was 35 years old. He was dying of a widely metastatic sarcoma, a bone tumor. He had graduated from the program in which I was training a few years earlier. He had two young children. He had a successful practice in what I consider to be one of the most beautiful cities in Southern California, in La Jolla. Life was fine until his arm had been removed and his shoulder and every bone and muscle down to his ribcage trying to cut away at the hands of a surgeon, cut away the tumor that was invading his body. When I met him, the tumor had metastasized far beyond that. I was at UCLA, it was an experimental center, and they tried some very weird things. One of the things that the specialty department decided might help is cooking. So they developed this big microwave oven. And we had to go down there. And they put him in the oven. Microwave oven. Yes, this is the world of my doctoring. And while this heat was supposedly cooking the tumor, I had to sit there and inject him with narcotics to try to ease it. This fellow was one of the most remarkable teachers I've had. Because he told me what it was like to be a patient, to be a doctor and a patient. And I sat there for several days through these 2.5-hour sessions each time. administering medication to this man. And you know what he did? He taught me. He talked to me. He talked to me about what it had been to be a young doctor, what he had learned, and what he had learned about what it was to be a doctor through his interaction with the medical system, with doctors who didn't seem to understand at all what it was to have a wound like he had. He dedicated the last months, he made it through a couple years of this, giving lectures to doctors, to patients, to families, about woundedness and healing. And he died. He was a doctor. He was my patient. And he was a teacher. A great teacher. Before I ever heard of Chiron, I knew Dr. Peters. When I heard of Chiron, I knew Dr. Peters. Another old doctor I knew, a very respected man, in very much the old style. He came from a medical family. His own father had written the classic textbook of medicine, which actually I looked up at a shelf the other day at work and saw that his name is still on that old textbook of medicine 3 generations later. And he was taking me to see a patient to do an exam, to teach me something. And as we were walking, he told me, he said, Dr. Owens, the most important thing in making a diagnosis, in developing a therapeutic plan, an understanding of prognosis, there are 3 things. 3 essential things. They are the history, and the history. Now, this man was famous as probably one of the best diagnosticians at Columbia when I was there. And I deeply respected him. Well, at first I thought that he had said that 3 times, sort of like a trishagion, you know, a word repeated thrice to emphasize its singular importance. But as time went on, and it has, I came to understand it a different way. It's not just that it's important, but it's history, history, and history. Sometimes before you hear the history, you have to hear it 3 times. You know, people, patients, they reveal themselves in layers. Clinical histories. Stories. Human stories. They're like onions. You peel them. If you peel them long enough, you start to cry. But sometimes you have to peel more than one layer away. Probe more than one time history. You know, sometimes it's really easy. Sometimes it's straightforward. And sometimes it isn't. Sometimes you simply have to listen. And listen. And listen. In giving lectures over in past years, it has been gently commented to me occasionally that some of my lectures seem to be awfully mixed up with rather obscure historical matters about the life of Carl Jung. And it has been suggested, gently, and sometimes not, that it might be more useful if I talked a bit more about personal psychology and archetypes and dream interpretation and such. Well, you know, Jung offered that sort of aid. He did. And next to a physician like that, all I can do is point. I don't have a whole hell of a lot to tack on. I want you to meet him. I would like to share his wisdom, the things I've heard from him, the things I've seen through my eyes of Dr. Jung, things that have been validated in my life experience now. But the paradox of this man, well, to understand what he offers you, to even really grasp the meaning of words like archetype, anima, animus, extrovert, introvert, objective psyche, collective unconscious, all those terms. To really grasp the meaning of those words, you have to know something about his life. History. 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 That experience that Jung recorded in a large red book, which he titled Liber Novus, the new book, the red book. Was born of events. Behind it, there is, if you will, a clinical history. History. A human life lived. Everything Jung wrote and spoke after about 1960, the second half of his very productive life, was derived from a human experience, a clinical experience. An experience that Jung, as an investigator and a patient and a doctor, attempted to record faithfully. It's a clinical record. But it is the record also of an incredible human story. It is the story of a man entering the unconscious, the world of myth and vision. It is also the story of a man witnessing God. Witnessing God. Those aren't easy words to speak, but that is a leitmotif of the Red Book. As Jung entered into this experience, he felt that he was touching the human experience that had from time immemorial been associated with what humans called an experience of God, not a metaphysical theorem of God, not a dogmatic affirmation, but the living power of an experience. And that experience was paradoxical. It was dark, and it was light. Now that sounds like some sort of religious affirmation. It sounds like, well, heresy to modern biases, modern assumptions, that a man and a woman cannot experience anything like God. Well, you know, because what? Because it's against the rules, you know. It's forbidden. It's morbid. It's crazy. It's pathological. And it also certainly represents a very serious disorder in the neurotransmitters of those brains. A very serious disorder. The Red Book of Jung is part of the clinical documentation of an extraordinary and historical human experience. It deserves to be met on those terms. Any understanding of Jung and his psychology starts at that point, in his experience of the soul, of a serpent, of a dove, of a paradoxical light and dark fact that humankind from time immemorial has associated with a word, a power word, a word, God. It's an experience of terror and wonder, and that is how Jung encountered it. For good reason, the biblical proverb, the first proverb, says, "The fear of God is the beginning of wisdom." So, are you interested in Jung? Here you are. Do you want to know something? Okay. If Jung is going to be your teacher, or your doctor, and thereby help you know something about the wound in us, in our society, in our time, the wound that he suffered also. If he's going to do that, you're going to have to meet him and meet his experience. I want you to approach Jung as a teacher and as a patient. Make this a clinical study, if you will. Let a patient teach you. Let a doctor who knew a wound in himself, who knew what it was to be a wounded patient, to seek a magical balm for a mortal and immortal wounding. And he left a clinical history, if you will. Look at Jung as a clinical case. Listen to him as you would to a very interesting patient. The most interesting patient I suspect you will ever meet. The most interesting one that I have ever met. The patient who has revealed himself as the greatest teacher I've known. But you first must listen to his story. History. History. His story. And her. Her story. The story he told of a human soul. His soul. Who he addressed as her. Long prologue. On the evening of 12 November 1913, Carl Gustav Jung arrived at the crossroads of his life. He felt a power emerging from the depths within him, compelling him toward actions he did not comprehend. Unexpected words were bubbling out of his unconscious, demanding his voice. He reached into a desk drawer, retrieved the journal he had abandoned 11 years earlier, and opened it to a blank leaf. Jung was 38 years old. He was a famous doctor, clinical investigator, and leader in the psychoanalytic movement. He sat in the study of a magnificent new mansion constructed for his family on the shores of Lake Zurich. I should add, constructed using the money of his wife, who was one of the richest women in Switzerland. He had married into an extremely wealthy family. But this night of 12 November 1913, he faced a far darker interior fact. During a decade of meteoric success, he had lost something precious. Jung had lost his soul, and he could go no further on that road of exile. Now she awaited him, and he knew he must meet her. He turned to the empty page of his journal, scribed the date at the top, and began. My soul. My soul. Where are you? Do you hear me? I speak, I call. Are you there? I have returned. I'm here again. I have shaken the dust of all the lands from my feet. And I have come to you. I am with you. After long years of long wanderings, I have come to you again. Do you still know me? How long the separation lasted? Everything has become so different. And how did I find you? How strange my journey was. What word should I use to tell you on what twisted paths a good star has guided me to you? Give me your hand. My almost forgotten soul. How warm the joy at seeing you again. You long disavowed soul. Life has led me back to you. My soul. My journey should continue with you. I will wander with you and ascend to my solitude. The experience. The dialogue. The odyssey that commenced that evening of 12 November 1913 and proceeded intensely for roughly the next 5 years transformed you. It is the source of that book, the Red Book, Liber Novus. In old age, Jung testified about the importance of this period, these years, this writing of this red book, he said. The years when I pursued the inner images were the most important time of my life. Everything else is to be derived from this. It began at that time. And the later details hardly matter anymore. My entire life consisted in elaborating what had burst forth from the unconscious and flooded me like an enigmatic stream and threatened to break me. That was the stuff and material for more than one life. Everything later. Everything later. Was merely the outer classification, the scientific elaboration, and the integration into life. But the numinous beginning, which contained everything, was then. But exactly what was it that happened? What was it he experienced? What did he see? What did he hear? What did he record? All of that led your journal. throughout the entirety of Jung's life remained his hidden mystery. Historians and biographers and critics struggled to explain this seminal period in his life. They called it a creative illness, kindly, a period of introspection. They also called it a psychotic break, or simply a madness. Lacking any factual foundation, however, all of these descriptions were speculations. Jung's own private clinical records of what happened to him, his ledger record of the experience, remained hidden. And Jung kept a detailed record. First, there were 6 sequentially dated journal books called the Black Books, which he began this night of 12 November 1913 and continued writing in through the 1920s. These journals might best be described as his primary and contemporaneous ledger of a voyage of discovery into imaginative and visionary reality. He called them the record of his most dangerous experiment. By 1915, as the magnitude of what he was undergoing struck him, he felt the need to prepare a more formal record. From his black books, he condensed a manuscript, and then that manuscript he transcribed into a special, large, folio-sized, red leather-bound volume he had commissioned. The book he had commissioned was blank, a book of 600 about blank pages. He had a golden title inscribed on the cover, Liber Novus, the new book. And into it, he began to transcribe the story of what had happened to him. Throughout his life, the red book, Liber Novus, remained veiled. Only a handful of patients saw it. Of course, it was in Jung's office. It was in his study. And during the teens and 20s, when he was still working on this thing, patients would come in for analysis, and they'd see it sitting there. They knew he was doing something. But very few of them had anything more than a glancing association with it. During his lifetime, it's impossible to say, really, but probably only a dozen or so people ever had a chance to read this entire record. And reading it is a task, as any of you who now own the big book know, of quite a bit more than an hour or two, or a day or two, or a month or two. In Zurich, I met a very fine analyst who, at a year and a half, says, "I'm almost finished." And, you know, she's not alone. I know a lot of people who have spent more than a year trying to struggle through Liber Novus. So if you're one of them, don't feel alone. After his death, the book, his death occurred on June 6th of 1961, 50 years and 3 months ago, plus or minus a few days. After his death, the family declined all, and they were many, requests to see the Red Book. It, for many years, sat in the study of Jung's house, where it had been pretty much all of his life. His grandson, Andreas Jung, who knew Jung, and whose father was Franz Jung, who, after Jung's death, lived in their house, told me about how, when he was a young Jung, he used to take the Red Book up to his bedroom to try to read it, because the pictures were so interesting. He said, "But it was very difficult. It's really big and heavy. It's hard to balance on your knees." Well, after about 20 years after Jung's death, the family understood the importance of the journal, and they were fearful for its safety, just sitting in a cabinet in the house. And so it was transported to a bank vault in Zurich. And for the last three decades, there it was locked, pretty much, in fact, probably entirely unseen by anybody. Now, a century after that record began, almost a century, both the book and the experience that produced the book have been opened with the full cooperation of Jung's heirs, his family. And after 13 years of exhaustively detailed, and I would add brilliant, editorial work, Dr. Sonu Chandasamy, as editor, was able to produce a translation, over 1,500 editorial notes, and publish the entire volume in a facsimile edition, a complete photographic copy of the original, followed by a detailed, well-edited, well-annotated translation. Including in that notational apparatus of Dr. Sonu Chandasamy, a lot of material from the original Black Book journals themselves, so that people can see and compare Jung's clinical journal with what he recorded in the Red Book. It's really, man, Sonu worked for 13 years on this. He's a brilliant man, and he works fast. What he did as an historian has read lots of stuff, and who knows Jung, I think what he did is amazing. In sum, this publication signals a watershed in the understanding of the life of Carl Gustav Jung, Dr. Carl Gustav Jung. In its light, our understanding of his story and his history begins anew. It is a revelation. Liber Novus, the new book, is the long hidden, the long occulted key to comprehending everything that Jung said and wrote after 1916. But it's also a singularly modern document, a book unlike any other, defying categorization or comparison. It fractures expectations. It speaks with voices beyond common ken. Can I ask, how many of you own a copy of the...
Yeah,
you know. Where do you put it? That's one of the biggest problems that I've found people who own the Red Book. Oh, wow, great, great. Where do you put it? There's no bookcase on earth, at least in any modern home that I know, that will fit the Red Book, lengthwise, widthwise, breadthwise, sidewise. And you don't want to leave it on the coffee table. I mean, it's the entire table. A book singular and beyond comparison in more than one way. You know, whether one approaches Liber Novus as an historian, a psychologist, a literary critic, a doctor, or just an interested reader, the puzzle is the same. What was the man doing? What was happening to him? How do we interpret the history and story of C.G. Jung? Jung well understood the problem. He had lived through it. Liber Novus is Jung's record of a journey into mythopoetic imagination, and it was a difficult passage. What confounds the reader now is the same issue that confronted Jung then. Though imaginative, mythic, fictive, apparently subjective, what Jung met in his wanderings spoke with the voice of an objective fact. It was independent, ineffably ancient, and yet intimately and synchronously involved with our human history. our human story. He perceived the visions, the voices, the images he encountered during this period as real. And the story they told had to him the tenor of a revelation. In private comments recorded by a close associate of his, Carey de Angulo Baines, in the 1920s, he expressed his own doubts about whether the work could ever be published or understood. Modern language lacked words with meanings vital enough to convey the nature of what he had experienced. You know, I just use the word revelation. He encountered it as a revelation. Huh? Modern word. Maybe it's a category. Huh? What is that? Is it a category you know anything about? How do you talk about such a thing? What words do you find to describe something that comes to you with the power of a revelation? Without sounding crazy. I've met a few people who thought they'd had revelations. And I thought most of them were pretty damn crazy. But not all of them. Not all of them. First, he saw that there had to come another crucial work. And let me step back. You know, when Jung wrote Liber Novus, he had every intention, based on all the documentary evidence of his experience, and when he was writing this book in this fancy folio volume, it seems quite apparent that he intended on publishing it. In the text of the Red Book, he addresses a readership, my friends, repeatedly. I mean, this wasn't a private aesthetic exercise. It was addressed to a readership. He just didn't know when that readership would come. By the late 1920s, he had understood that he may never publish it, that it wouldn't be understood, that before it could be understood, he had to develop a hermeneutic. What does that word mean? Hermeneutic. The way of understanding or interpreting, exactly. It's based on the word Hermes. Hermes was the messenger of God. He was the ancient mythic interpreter. He was the one who conveyed messages between realms of light and dark, between gods and men. Hermeneutic, the hermeneutic art, was the art of being the messenger. But you see, the messenger is an interpreter, taking this and bringing it to that, taking this from gods, bringing it here to men. Or theologically, which is where one encounters the word hermeneutics mostly in our given age, is the art of interpreting scripture, divine writ, finding this God message and conveying it in some technique to humankind. He had to develop some hermeneutic to his enterprise, some method to his madness. So in 1928, he set aside his work on Liber Novus and he turned to that extended enterprise. But as he said late in life, all of that was a commentary on this experience. A hermeneutic, an exegesis, a technique, a reading, a way of approaching events that had happened to him, that he had experienced. So we now have the record of that experience, a transformative journey of discovery that lasted in intensity for about 5 years. And we have the corpus of Jung's public enterprise, his hermeneutic. His hermeneutics to a vision. extracted from a crucible of vision over the following 40 years of his life work. And finally, now, since publication of the book in October of 2009, we have them together. And we can begin to see how in Jung they wed. But like much of Jung's work, this is a circular course. Liber Novus and the hermeneutic enterprise it fomented form a paradoxical complexio. Neither can be what it was until it has the other with it as it is. The experience and the knowledge, insight, granted by the experience. The experience of a wound and the knowledge of the healing, of the approach, of the depth and of the balm to the wound. They cannot be understood until brought together. The experience and the knowledge granted by the experience is one. Vision revealed a hermeneutics. The hermeneutics demand confrontation with the vision. All of his life work is an interpretive restatement of this experience. As Jung said, around 1958, Daniela Jaffe, everything later was merely the outer classification, the scientific elaboration, and the integration into life. But the numinous beginning, which contained everything, was then. Once we enter the realm of Liber Novus, it is impossible to read any of Jung's collected works, anything he wrote thereafter, without hearing its echoing voice. And I give you testimony of that based upon experience. I have gone back. I've read maybe not everything Jung wrote, but it's getting damn close. And after my first encounter with the Red Book, which I read several times over a period of months, I finished my first reading probably in a week. I sat there trembling. It was the thing I was most curious about in my entire life. And when I opened it up, you know what I found? I found what I thought I was going to find. It was a confirmation of things that I'd felt and seen and understood about this man from the day I met him. And I couldn't put it down. Not to say I understood it all the first time. I didn't. And I probably don't understand it all now. It could take an idiot to proclaim profound and ultimate knowledge of a thing like the Red Book. And there are a few idiots, of course. And sometimes I'm one of them. But anyway, I went back actually after doing that and I started reading the collected works. Again, it was like, you know, I started putting little LNs as I went through reading things, my favorite powerful things in the collected works. I didn't read it all. I mean, it was a hell of a lot. And putting little LNs next for things I saw that were just absolutely direct references to this experience in Liber Novus. I could not, I mean, I played a game. I had the complete, you know, the collected works of C.G. Jung, the 20 volumes. One of them's a bibliography and one of them's an index. So they're, you know, maybe 18 real volumes. So I made a game. I would like pick a volume off the table and open it to a page and see how many pages I could read before I could come to something that I felt really was directly influenced by Liber Novus. And I never made it more than two or three pages. I wouldn't call that a valid statistical sample. And I suppose if you take a computer analysis of the collected works, you may find that I'm entirely wrong. But the synchronistic fact is that's what happened to me. That's the way I experienced it. And officer, I'm sticking with that story. So once we enter the realm of Liber Novus, it's really impossible to read Jung without seeing its its power. Encountered anew with Liber Novus in hand, the greater sum of Jung's subsequent writings is revealed as a vast hermeneutical project, intent on opening to modern comprehension his experience, Jung's experience, his experience, Jung's record, his record, and its centering fact, a wound, a wound. A terrible wound. The forgotten reality of the human soul. Let's take a break right there. And I hope there's coffee, because I got more.